So let's get this out of the way first. I saw a great thread, a great three-post thread on Twitter, X the Everything app, from Jessica Rain, new mom and comrade and friend, talking about all of the texts that we're getting before the general election. All I know is that Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor and Short King, known Short King, he's sent me probably 11, 12, 13 text messages. I've been scolded. I've been told we've asked you 9 times whether you're going to vote for Kamala Harris. I was told that it was going to be a 900% match, which I don't even not even sure what that means.
I said that as a joke in a previous episode, I think talking about John Tester. I don't know if you guys remember this.
I kind of do.
Was like, after I said it, I was like, oh, you shouldn't have like embellished that much. It's probably 3 times match. No, I got the same one.
Yeah, John Tester. Look, John Tester, he's in the mix right now. He's not at all. No, he's not. I mean, look, we can get a 1000% match if we've asked you 9 times if you're going to vote for Harris Waltz. But Jess's point was these texts are extremely fucking stupid. Like, again, I understand it's like, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, you get mailers and get junk mail and you don't get as much junk mail. You get junk email. So, okay, I get that part of it. And I also get the part that, and maybe this is something that Carl can chime in on. I guess people do respond to it in some fashion. Some cohort of people respond to these with money, I guess. Is that true?
So my understanding is there's sort of 3 different versions of this. One is the ones that like we do for WFP or for WFP or for any campaign, which is a direct campaign text that's usually not actually a fundraising text. It's usually something related to getting out an issue or asking for a response or this or that. That's a specific campaign outreach tactic. The second is like these grassroots. So if you see one that has like a screenshot, like a headshot at the top, it's like, hey, this is, and then it's like some general that Trump dissed in like 2018.
Mad Dog Mattis.
And then it's like 3 paragraphs of text. And it's like, can I count on a donation for $50 right now or something? And that is usually sent out by some digital fundraising firm that specializes in this thing. It's usually pretty general lists or specific lists that they think are going to have a higher rate, which is probably like you're probably on like the lefty list, and so that's why you're getting Robert Reich.
That seems fair.
And
that
so
fair. Sort of like when Steve Wood was like, are you a Marxist too? And you're like, yeah.
And so then the third one is these complete nonsense spam texts, which I'm sure you've gotten some as well, which is just like they just have like a 3-letter thing. It's like FDO.
I have DCDC. Have you gotten DCDC?
No.
Wait,
maybe.
Explain more about this style.
And so it's just like, it's just a sentence. And it's like, now, we need donations now. And then it's like a short link. And then it's like some acronym that they don't explain what it means. And it's like, stop the quit. And those are like the lowest of the low. And I'm getting like 4 of those a day now.
Yeah, as Jess pointed out, the thing is, these don't, like, again, I understand they're very cheap and you can get them out, but like, it just seems so pointless.
Yeah, I mean, here's one I got 2 hours ago. We need a huge day, so if I'm emphasizing it, it means it's all cash.
Yeah, huge.
We need a huge day to crush Ted Cruz. All gifts, 3x matched, $20 equals $60, donate on Act Blue. And then it's just Democrats 2024.
Okay. I feel like this probably hits with people who are like self-diagnosed ADHD. It's like they get right to the point. You know, there's dollars. There's hopefully emojis involved, a lot of caps.
So I've gotten 6 of those today. Oh, baby, it's not possible.
Comrades and friends, I think we're doomed. From the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. This is Rob. This is your Highlands Bunker podcast. Hello. How are you? If you're like us, you're getting lots of stupid texts. I'm excited tonight to have a new guest who I've been working with, I guess, about 9 months, 10 months, just this year, right? Yeah. But first, let me introduce our friend Bill, who's here. Thank you, Bill, for coming.
Good evening.
Carl, who's here. Thank you, Carl, for coming. He shakes his head. Our guest tonight is Tanya Whittle. Tanya is a member of the Newcastle County Police Accountability Board. She's also the new policy director of the Delaware Center for Justice. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so it's so cool. Tanya also was at the Nicole conference that we did a show from there. So we were learning. We were getting information from people. That was cool. But yeah, so we started working together just this year. When I went to DCJ, and then you got a position on the Newcastle County Police Accountability Board, and now are at DCJ as well. I usually ask people, like, where they're from, what it was, you know, how they grew up, what it was like, to kind of suss out what might have pulled people towards activism, advocacy, public policy. But I have a specific question for you, because it came up when we were in Tucson. And you, I don't know how it came up, but you mentioned that you had lived in Australia. So I tried to be like somebody who knows like something about Australia. And I said, so did you live on like in Western Australia, like in Perth on the coast, or on the East Coast with like in Sydney and Melbourne and all that? Because everybody lives just sort of on those coasts. And Tanya said, oh no, I was in the bush. Basically, can you explain where you lived and how you wound up in the Australian bush and what it was like?
Sure. So, as you are alluding to, yeah, like 90% of people in Australia live along the coast, and it makes a lot of sense. But the town I lived in was Alice Springs, and it is literally in the center of the continent, and it was intentionally put there as a telegraph relay station back when the telegraph lines were originally put in place. And then during World War II, when there was bombings along the northern coast, a lot of the Department of Defense sort of stuff got moved inland. And now there's a joint base there, Department of Defense base, that my parents worked at when I was a kid. And so when I was a child, I grew up over in Australia, was there 8.5 years, all of elementary school, and then moved to America for a couple of years, and that was a serious culture shock, and then moved to Germany and moved back to America. And yeah, in each of these places, I was always noticing how the culture and the laws and the policies play. And even whenever I was little, I was like, what do you mean I have to wear a dress at school? You know, I'm changing the school policy. And so I don't know exactly where it came from, but I think growing up in a country that was a penal colony definitely influenced me going into these realms.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you're the policy person, not the political person. That's not something you're down with. I like that. Actually, that we talk about that a lot. Like there's ways to be sort of productive in this work, and sometimes it's not like sending emails or text messages or like 600% match. You know, it just doesn't work that way.
Just out of curiosity, like of those, I guess it was the three countries, Germany, Australia, States. I guess I kind of know, I'm familiar with the States, but what are policy directives? How are they communicated in Germany and Australia? Are there laws, are there codes, like is there just like a lot of shit written down, for lack of a better expression, or is there are policies sort of more just like communicated among neighbors, constituencies, whatever?
So I will have to be honest and say that I was pretty young when I was there, so I wasn't True. Heavily involved in politics. But even in elementary school, I remember them talking about, you know, whether or not there should be mining and the effects of yellow cake and how that affects, you know, like it, there was definitely lots of conversation about social topics. And like even on TV, we had two TV stations when I was a kid. Like that's all we had in town. And they would regularly have PSAs, like public service announcements. But I don't really remember a whole lot about politics. You know, it was not so much like the individual people running for races. But whenever I came to the States, it was, I think, it was like Ross Perot, Bill Clinton, and
1992, maybe.
That's 96. It was 96. Yeah.
Yeah, because 92, I famously, my first vote as an 18-year-old college student was for H. Ross Perot. Again, I was 18, so you know, just kind of give me a little break here.
My first content analysis was of newspapers and looking at that election. And granted, I was in sixth grade, but I was like, yeah, Ross Perot, that's my guy. Yeah. And part of it was because at that age, I was like always rooting for the underdog.
Yeah. He was a funny guy, too.
Yeah. I mean, of all sort of like the libertarian third party guys, he was the most sort of like righteous guy. He didn't have like pretense or like he wasn't like an Elon Musk figure. He'd be like, you know, it's like, look, here's what I'm going to do. We need these jobs. You know, and he's put charts up and shit. And he was a weird guy. But on reflection, I think as an 18-year-old, I knew like that the two-party system was like,
it's not for me, man.
Yeah, I was rejecting the two-party system. You know what? Don't make fun of it.
No.
I know. But you saying H. Perot just reminded me of that. So when did you settled in the U.S. at some point and stayed, went to school? You spent some time in Florida? I definitely want to talk about that before we get into some policy stuff because that place is it's an interesting place to me. My parents have gone down there. I've been down there a little bit. It's a very strange place, I find. I've never been on the panhandle where you were, so I'm interested in hearing about that. But what was the experience like? How old were you? And were you there for school or were you working? Around what age was this?
I lived in Florida multiple times. I was born in Florida in 93. I was back there just like did a couple of months because my parents are going through a divorce. And they're like, yeah, go stay with your grandparents for a while we sort this out. And then came back in 96, again in 98. And then I've stayed living in the U.S. since then. I lived in Tennessee, Texas, Florida. Like I've moved around a few different places, but each time I came back to the United States and like coming to the panhandle of Florida, it was a serious culture shock. Like on one hand, people would be surprised that I knew what certain kinds of cars were and, oh, you had flushing toilets, really? And they'd be like shocked in that regard. But I also had a lot of culture shock where I remember it's always fairly good in school, but then I get these math questions all of a sudden. They're like, all right, you have two nickels, a dime, and a quarter. How much money do you have? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like,
you're like, a dime? Like,
yeah. And I even had a teacher say, like, what, you don't have money where you come from? I'm like, well, yes, but we don't have these cute little pet names for it.
Right.
Or I remember
Australia doesn't have cute pet names for its currency.
Yeah. Well,
Canada, I highly doubt that.
Canada they call it like a koala.
Like a wiki kiwi.
Because even Canada has the loony and all that. Yeah, they have that stuff.
But
I think they just, because it's just, I think they just call it a dollar. I don't even think they call it like anything stupid. But yeah, so you're like, oh, a dime and a nickel. Like, I'm sorry, I don't follow your stupid customs.
Thought we were in math, not vocabulary.
Yeah.
And then even trying to be like, okay, I want to buy this $9.99 book. I have a $10 bill. What do you mean I don't have enough money?
No.
Like, so like confusion in that regard. But I also, you know, growing up on media and stuff, there was this idea that like the United States is the future. They've gone through all of this like civil liberation and like sexism is not as much an issue, racism and like all of that. And then I moved to the South and it was like going back in time. Like there was race fights at my school, and it's like, you know, at the bus, like everyone is like, they knew it was going to happen. And so if you didn't want to be a part of the fight, you just like packed your bag extra slow sort of thing. Like a lot of racial division that like just really surprised me. And yet no one knew the history of the United States. Like that was one of the big things that shocked me was, even though I had grown up overseas, I felt like I had more of an education of American history than my classmates did. And like, especially when it came to civil liberties, like one of the first questions I would get asked whenever I lived in Fayetteville, Tennessee, was, which church do you go to? And I said, I don't. And they're like, you can do that? And so just like this complete unawareness of what America is, you know, like, what I really like envisioned was the quintessential like meat and potatoes of America was not even something they thought about. And I was like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about that all the time. Like nobody, history is the one thing that's taken out of it. It's more about like myth and vibes. Like, yes. Like we have vibes. We just go by vibes. And again, I think other, I mean, I've traveled too. And I think to a certain extent, a lot of these countries go by vibes. Australia definitely goes by vibes. Vibes I don't like. They're surfers. They're going to steal your girlfriend. They're going to drink all your beer. And they're going to try to be your friend. They're not your friend. I don't like Australia.
Sydney Opera House is probably too expensive to get tickets.
Yeah.
I have to just take pictures of it from outside.
These guys, they're throwing another shrimp on the Barbie.
But there's also like a beauty to the roughness of it. I mean, like, there was a river in my town that was dry 99% of the time, and we still had boat races on it, right?
That's classic. That's right? Classic Aussie
stuff.
You cut
the bottom out of the boat, and you run it down the riverbed. Yeah. Like, it's like the only boat race that they actually have insurance in case it rains.
So you're back in the States. You choose a life of academia and scholarship. How did you find your way to Delaware?
So before I went the route of academia, I mean, I did go to college and I was really interested in psychology and criminal justice issues. A lot of it. I mean, I remember when I was a young kid, even noticing that almost every time I saw someone in the back of a police truck, like, you know, not a closed in, but like a caged truck, because in Australia, it's too hot to leave someone in an air-conditioned.
We're in the bush, folks. I don't know if you guys have seen Crocodile Dundee, but that's what we're doing right now.
But like, I remember even as a small kid noticing that the people that were locked up were always Aboriginal, right? So always Native Australians. And so whenever I came to the States and I saw all these issues that were supposedly solved, I was like, I want to be part of the solution. And I thought I was going to work in the system. And so I did like ride-alongs with police. I was a criminal justice major. And I learned that a lot of the policing in the area that I was in was really criminalizing poverty. Like, I even had police officers that I was doing ride-alongs with say like, hey, you see that guy? He's walking on the side of the road and it's Florida and hot as hell. So that probably means he doesn't have a driver's license, and that's probably because he's on probation. Let's go, like, check him out. And it was just like, whoa, this is not what I want to do. And, you know, all right. So I took a step back. I was like, okay, I'll go with probation route, right? And learn, you know, that I think that was a good exposure, but I recognize like a 22-year-old should not be in position to take someone else's liberties. And although I, you know, would like to think I was somewhat mature, the emotional maturity that you need for that kind of job, like, I just recognized, like, okay, this isn't right for me. Kept going to school. And I did education and training, developed education and training, online education and training for one of the projects was developing training for the Minnesota Police Department. It was written by an attorney, and then we would actually, like, make it where it was, you know, online and all of that. But so I eventually just, like, okay, I can't stay in the South. I went to D.C. for a bit. And then eventually I decided I want to go on to grad school and did my research online, found the University of Delaware, and I was attracted to them because they were both a sociology and a criminal justice program. They had the Center for Drug and Alcohol Studies at the time. It's now the Center for Drug and Health Studies, and that was like right up my alley. And then they also the Inside Out program, the Inside Out Prison Exchange program. And because I'm really interested in education and corrections, I was like, all right, this is the place for me. And so my goal was to come here, get my degree, and get the hell out, because I didn't know anything about Delaware. But that's now I've actually lived in Delaware longer than anywhere else in my life. And I say I'm a Delawarean by choice. So you guys all have the roots, but I have the decision in it.
Like Bill says, it sucks you in. Yeah. you get stuck in. You can't get out of it.
Well, and to bring it full circle, you had that item you wanted to purchase for $9.99. Now you could buy it with a $10 bill, right?
Exactly. No. Because there's no sales tax here. That's why I feel comfortable here. You
go. That's incredible. Yeah. So the first time we met was when I started doing this work in January for ODS and DCJ, and you had a huge sort of desire to get on this Newcastle County Police Accountability Board. And what was your expectation? Like, did you go into it sort of feeling like, hey, I know what this is, and I'm gonna go for it and try to do this strategy, or did you just say, I'm going to do it and we'll figure it out afterwards? Did you know kind of how difficult it was going to be based on the rules around it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Did you know, like, did you go into it sort of like thinking that, or did you go into it thinking like, I'm going to do all this stuff, and then realize that you're not going to do that?
So I think that I was fortunate going into it in that I wasn't wearing rose-colored glasses, didn't have the impression that we're just going to wave magic wands, that all of a sudden it's going to be this kumbaya kind of situation. But I also didn't realize how much time and energy being a part of the board would be, especially since there's, you know, subcommittees and being a part of the research committee and
trainings,
yeah,
which is a cool thing, but you're right, that is time consuming for a volunteer position.
Yeah
it's so tons of, it's actually, we talked about this in Tucson. Yeah, we talked about this in Tucson a little bit and before. Yeah, it's a lot of like requirements on your time for like just not even the meetings but training and other things. Yeah, have you been on more ride-alongs where you've pulled over of people on probation that are walking along the side of the road? Because that's the thing. Like, everybody thinks, like, oh, Florida's so bad, we're probably doing the same stuff here when you get into it.
I haven't done my ride-alongs yet here with Newcastle County. I actually just completed my paperwork, and so once I scan that in, I'll be starting it up. So looking forward to that. And they also have us doing training with the Newcastle County Police. They did one session that was looking at the history, policies, you know, basics, as far as what they look for when hiring. And then I think right before Thanksgiving, we're going to be doing an in-person on use of force training. So that'll be really important.
That should be very
with
interesting.
Policies we're being asked to look at.
Yeah, that should be extremely interesting. So I don't know if you got a chance to look at these or if you have an opinion about them, but part of the legislation that created these police accountability boards, or mandated that they should be created, whether they're created or not is, you know, another thing.
This is still the sole police accountability board, right, in the state?
No. There's about, so let me try to
first though.
I'm sure it was the first. It's definitely the one that is the most robust in the sense that it was created by a council ordinance, and it was implemented by the Meyer administration, which,
getting,
you know,
shit done.
Look, gets shit done. This is not an endorsement. This is just, I've heard it on the internet.
The thumbs up for me.
Sure, I'm with it. But there are some other ones. Now the tricky part is, and we've talked about this before, so the Meyer administration at the county set a board up that is probably the best it can be with restraints and things. all the other boards that have been set up are some are completely different. So, for example, there is a Sussex County Police Accountability Board that is three departments in one board. That's how they set it up. It's in Ocean View. I believe it's Selbyville, Ocean View, and Western Bethany, maybe. It's three Sussex counties. There is one in Seaford and one in Dover that were basically like police chief advisory boards that became police accountability boards. So they were already sort of set up by the cops and then like migrated over to the mandate.
I guess this is what we have to do now.
We have to do. So I guess you guys, we're going to change your name. Like we're going to, oh, it's a different name now. It's not Leo Bohr, Pod Pat. The Delaware State Police have one. Here's a funny story about that, which I think you know because Misty told it at the conference. So, of course, a lot of these places don't send out, like, press releases. They just do it, you know. So the Delaware State Police had a board. They had a meeting. We found out about it. And so the following month, the following meeting, I said, I'm gonna go on virtually to see what the fuck they're up to. You know, I'm going to see what they're up to. And so I go on virtually, and it opens up into like a Microsoft Teams or whatever, and it's me in the studio with two other people in the Teams. You know, you have the stick figure up here that says so and so DSP, Delaware State Police, and then another one says so and so DSP, Delaware State Police. So I'm like, okay, I must be in the right place because there's two people here. 5 minutes go by. 10 minutes go by. 15 minutes go by. I'm like, hello, hello. What are we doing here? Hey. So I just, nothing. You know, they must be on mute. I just hang up. Go back to ODS. I say, what the fuck is going on here? They go to the Delaware State Police, talk to the person who's in charge of this. They said, oh, we're so sorry. That link was for public comment. The meeting was happening, but we didn't know that had to be public. So the meeting was happening over here, and you were just in the public comment room.
Immediate FOIA violation on the play.
Yeah, I'm like the we're throwing the flag. We're like we're blowing the whistle. We're going to VAR. We're like we got to go to VAR and check this out. We got to do the vector lines and check it out for offside because I think this goal was offside.
I don't even want to think if they did their like agenda publication rules correctly. Oh boy, and these are the DSP.
Well, yeah. So the people in ODS, they were like, we have a. You know, we have a colleague or a you know somebody at DSP we can talk to. And that's what they told him, and I'm like, okay, but yeah, it's stuff like that. Like, I mean, famously, this is another thing Misty mentioned at the panel discussion. The post committee, which is now used to be copped, now it's post. It's like the state agency that. Sort of oversees standards and practices and all of this stuff. They were posting meetings. They were like, here's our meeting. Here's our agenda. Here's a decred meeting. Like when they're going to decredential, here's the credential one. And we're like, oh, you're decredentialing, but I don't have an agenda. I don't have any information. They just took it off. They just took it off the public website. That's how they handled it. So I'm like, we got to go to VAR on this. Yeah, I think this might be against the law. Yeah. I think they might be breaking the law right now. But again, you can't say anything because it's like, oh, they don't know. They don't know. You know.
Who are you going to call the cops?
Like, I'm going to dial 911. The state police are not following public notice record laws. Yeah.
Very pedantic FOIA violation I'd like to complain about.
Yeah. So, it's, I mean, obviously, you're deep involved in a lot of this. How have you found it? Because I know there's been some, I don't want to say fights, because Bill's here. He's a dedicated county employee. But I do know that the police have really tried to be pedantic, as you said, and be like, I don't know if you can do this. I don't know if you can do that. Like, how have you found just work on the board and trying to just get information and work with, say, the police? What's your view?
So, I mean, there's different people from the police that we engage with and different settings. And so depending on setting and who's around, like we have very different, levels of conversation. And in general, like I think overall people have been very cordial, especially when, having side conversations and interacting, before and after board meetings. But there's also been some really contentious times. I mean, really, a lot of the time and effort I feel that should have been going in the last few months into getting public feedback and doing research, analyzing policies, comparing to other standards, talking with the police officers and, all of that. Before we can even get to that sort of thing, we've been getting hung up with just red tape. A lot of the people that are on the board, myself included, haven't been on boards like this before. We're not truly familiar with Robert's rules. And some of us are just like, well, I don't care if I say it right. I'm going to put my hand up. But some of the other people are very timid. And so we've been having to figure out how to get all the voices, even of the board members, heard, let alone getting to the public comment and whatnot. We have had open public comment at the end of each public meeting. And that has been really good. Some of the meetings have had incredible turnout, but we recognize that not everyone can show up to a meeting in person. Not everyone is comfortable sharing input in a public setting like that. And so we were like, hey, we need to have a public feedback form in order to be able to let people submit information, whether by mail or online. And we've been talking about trying to get this public feedback form in place since month 2. And I think now we're at month 10. And it's, on one hand, ridiculous that it's taken us this long just to develop a form and make it available. But the reason that it's been so slow going is because we've been told by various entities that we will be in violation of LEABOR or PODPAT if we collect information that could be construed as a complaint and have an officer's name or other identifying information. And then when there was, some back and forth around that and whether or not LEABOR or PODPAT applied to us as a board, then it was, well, then there's FOIA concerns, right? And it's like, okay, well, none of this actually makes sense because we're not part of the accountability process in the legal sense of the word, in the HR sense of the word, even though accountability is written in our title. We have no teeth. We're not actually able to demand evidence, do investigations. We can't make people testify. We have no bearing really on people's, and when I'm saying people, police officers' conduct evaluation. And so these don't apply to us. But being threatened with lawsuits puts enough, fear of God in people where they're like, well, we need to make sure we're not doing anything wrong before we move forward. And so because we have been not given a lawsuit, but told if you do that, you can expect a lawsuit, we have yet to even put out a public form, a feedback form, so that people can submit information. One of the things that I've been pushing back on the current draft of the form that has been developed because it has, red letters saying we cannot accept complaints, right? Complaints must be submitted through these official avenues. And on one hand, I understand that if someone is wanting something to be dealt with through a formal mechanism, we can't pretend hey, just give us the information. People need to be informed of the proper mechanisms. But I'm also very, I have a huge issue with collecting data, especially as a social scientist, collecting data and starting out from the, but we're not going to accept this kind of data, especially when the layperson is not going to know what is formally considered a complaint. And if we want to talk about the way laws can be interpreted or even how communication can be done. I was playing devil's advocate at one of the meetings and I was saying okay, so if I say, hey, I think you did a really good job tossing that kid up against a car. That was fantastic how you didn't actually read them their Miranda rights. Is that a complaint? Right? Because I'm saying something positive, right? Yeah. Or I'm complimenting.
That inflection in your voice.
Yeah. And so whenever I brought that up, and like I was doing it in part to be a smartass, but also to make a point that we can't be policing at the collection level. We can then make sure to have protocol to protect people submitting information, the people that are being referred to in the submitted information. But I can't vote for a form that says, don't actually tell us what's happened, only tell us good things.
Yeah, what we saw, I mean, the concept of independent investigation that we saw some boards have and some agencies have and some agencies don't, yours doesn't. And so there's this idea that we want to make sure, I'm just speaking like the police interest here. We want to make sure that outside power, outside forces, outside agencies, independent investigators don't have any purview into this. So we want to make sure you know that real investigation by law is only going to come from us. This isn't real investigation. But rather than just saying that, which kind of gives away the game, they say, like, this isn't a real complaint. It's not the pedantic thing. Like, a complaint gets investigated and only we investigate. So we can't call it a complaint. So they're playing this kind of game where you could very easily say, you can pass this complaint along to the board. We're going to take it. We're going to analyze it. We're going to follow up on it. We're going to do all we, but we cannot, unfortunately, independently investigate it. We can't produce a specific finding or do anything about, discipline, but we can take it. But they don't want that. They don't want it to be clear, right?
It's very unclear. Hold on. So I assume that the accountability board would like this complaint receipt. It's anonymous, I imagine. Complaint process. So because people would feel intimidated to take complaints directly to law enforcement. Is that part of the equation at all?
That's part of the equation. Okay. And then there's also that some people feel like they are being dismissed or they have to report something multiple times before it gets attention. There's a lot of reasons that people may not come forward, but then also they may not physically be able to make it to the public meetings to tell the accountability board at the current
time. I just feel like some people want to, they don't want to fill out a document and hand it to a cop to be like, here's my complaint. They want to go to a public meeting or in a public setting or an accountability board and make their complaint that way. Because they feel more comfortable, obviously. You know, if the cop, if you have a complaint against the police, what are you going to fill out a form and hand it to the police? You feel like a fucking asshole. People feel more comfortable doing this. Now, should they know that the board does not have, investigative authority? Yeah, in some fashion, they should probably know that. But they should also know that the board cares about this, and this is going to be very important to their work to be able to figure out trends, to be able to figure out what the fuck is going on out there? And so that's what I think it is, actually, is that people just generally would prefer to do it in a public setting with regular citizens on a board than go and fill out a thing and give it to a cop to investigate the cop who's, the cop from the thing that they did. Like, it's, you know what I mean? That's how I take it, actually. And there's a, what's happening is that because of this investigative and Leobor aspect to it, the cops are like, well, you're not really officially giving it to anybody, so don't give it to them because they don't want them to have it. That's my take on it, And again, I think I've been to every public meeting. I might have missed one. But yeah, I see what goes on there, and it's shifty. We'll just say it's dodgy.
Well, my only suggestion would be: I assume this is like this is like a FOIA issue, but you could get like a, some SJW legislator in the Delaware General Assembly to honestly, you know, run a bill that amends FOIA to allow this kind of communication to an accountability board. I don't know how likely it is, but hey,
well, here's
you guys, you guys are a powerful, organized body right now.
And here's the other thing we've been talking about. This came up also at the, so DCJ had a big Visions for Justice conference at the Route 9 Library last week on Friday. It was huge. It was awesome. It was multiple rooms going on. I got to be on an expert panel. You know, when that happens, I'm like, hey. Tanya was the facilitator of the expert panel. But I lost my train of thought because I was giving myself a pat on the back.
Yeah, look at you.
I know. This is the thing that came up. Misty brought it up, but this is something we talked about a day or two beforehand. The Inspector General's office is it's got a lot of heat right now. Everybody's into it. You know, Senator Laura Sturgeon, our friend, Carl's mom, Carl's political mom, not real mom. I know Carl's real mom too, so I don't. You know, the Delcog people, Flattery, Kowalko. Claire, we love you. Just remember, you're a Gramsci scholar. You don't have to get pulled into it. That's all I'm saying.
She more into Inspector Gadget than the Inspector General these
days? But for example, the Inspector General's office would be a good place to, by law, by statute, give the office the power to do oversight and independent investigations of agencies. Now, the issue is, in Delaware, because it's so stupid, we defer to local rule. This is why, like, Seaford tried to do the LLC voting. This is why they changed the charter, and we just defer to that. Now, again, local rule is sort of like states' rights. I feel like U.S. Grant and W.T. Sherman took care of that, like, 150 years ago. We sort of took care of it. I mean, we'll do it again if we need to, but if the state takes sort of authority over a municipal police department, it's kind of tough shit. You know what I mean? Sorry. State's on it. You have 12 people at some podunk fucking police department. You're beating everybody up. State's stepping in. Sorry. Oh, local rule? Sherman marched to the sea. You know, whatever. That's my idea, is I think at the state level, as you said, there can be some overarching law that be like, yeah, we have something that's going to watch out for this, because just leaving it to these morons right. is not sufficient. Plus,
Wait a minute,
you mean the fucking Delmar Police Department isn't on the up and up? Get out of here! You're kidding me. Yeah. So. Two things before we go. Number one, I really had a good time doing the panel discussion at the DCJ thing. How have you found that? How have you found, so you've been at DCJ like a month, 2 months, something like that?
Yeah, 2 months. Coming to the tail end of 2 months at the moment. It's been great so far.
Because obviously you're not just doing police stuff. You're doing all manner of DCJ sort of services, which is like, people coming back from being locked up, people, just all kinds of services. So how do you find it?
It's been amazing. So DCJ, I've been kind of stalking in some ways since I moved to the state. Whenever I was doing my research on prisoner reentry, it was one of the organizations. I was like, one day I'm going to work there. And so far, I've been really happy. A lot of the projects that I've been assigned to are things that I was already really passionate about. And so, for instance, I'm supposed to be keeping an eye on police accountability boards. It helps being on a police accountability board and trying to keep track of posts and all of that just to have my bearings. But we're also working on probation reform. There's a lot of work that I've been doing looking at compassionate release and wanting to address death by incarceration in the state. So the number of lifers, people serving LWOP and even virtual life sentences has been expanding for quite a while. And so trying to develop some mechanisms for release as well as stopping so many people from getting these kinds of sentences. Some clean slate work, particularly looking at the way that, although we've recently put in automated expungement, there are still issues with if you have fines and fees or restitution that can prevent people getting even this automatic expungement. And so trying to address costs of clearing your record, but also going and looking at cost of incarceration. So one of the projects that I was a part of with the Campaign to End Debtors Prison, HB 244 a couple of years back addressed fines and fees and the connection to suspension of driver's licenses. And so we had made some good work through that bill, but one of the pieces was for there to be a study group. And although, you know, I know a lot of people roll their eyes when it comes to study groups.
I was getting ready to stop. It sounds like a fucking task force. Carl's going to just hit the fucking end the thing.
Yeah, I know a lot of people grumble about these task force being created and just like really being nothing burgers. And that's always a risk or a potential. I mean, same with these police accountability boards. One of the reasons I wanted to get involved was, well, how they're structured and how they are running makes a lot of difference. And so especially as it's being set up, like, okay, I want to be a part of that. But out of that study group, we ended up having multiple subgroups. And so there were people looking at fines, at fee elimination, at old debt, but we also had a subgroup looking at cost of incarceration. So the not just how much are taxpayers paying to run corrections, but also looking at how much are people having to pay at commissary? How much does it cost to get medication? If you want to have a photo during your visit with family, how much does that cost? And although a lot of these things are really small in some ways, when you consider that they're making like 18, 40 some odd cents an hour, it makes a difference. And so some of the work that came out of that, like that one subgroup, couldn't agree on any recommendations. Like we came to a stalemate. However, we did get to publish a lot of information that we previously didn't have before. And now a group related to Campaign to End Debtors Prison, they got a grant and are now, for the next 2 days, we're going to be having meetings to start this project that's going to involve, you know, national researchers and collaborators to continue digging into costs of incarceration, particularly hitting the pockets of inmates and their supporting families.
Shout out to Lynn and Miriam too.
Yes,
Campaign in Dennis Prison. I think I'm contractually obligated to say that. we love you guys. Come on. The last thing I want to talk about, because it's like a plug. So this will come out on Friday. On Friday evening, as part of the Art Loop, I got this information to go to the bookstore on Market Street because Professor Yasser Payne is going to be there, and they're going to talk about this sort of rethinking Murdertown USA, and there's going to be a thing. And who does it say is going to be moderating the discussion? Tanya Whittle.
No way.
She's fucking everywhere. So
is this the most times you've moderated something in a week?
In a week, maybe, yeah. Because
this will be three times in a week. This is a record moderation.
Yeah.
So what? So I know Dr. Yasser Payne. He's been here. He sat where Bill sat. I also know the guy who produced and wrote and sort of starred in a sense. Murdertown USA, Zach Phillips, but his name isn't there, so I don't know whether he's going to be there or not. Okay. And there's an artist who's going to be like music by so-and-so. I have no idea what kind of music it is, so I thank God you're here, so I'm hoping you can give me some information about what I'm getting into on Friday. Tonight, as you're listening to this, tonight at the Art Loop from 5 to 8, go.
Sure. Sure. So Huxley and Hero, they're having a discussion. There's going to be a display of photography, a photography project that's done by Jesse Simmons, and it's focusing on homelessness and structural inequality, looking at how the resources you have available to you when you're coming out of prison really affects your opportunities. And through photos and also interviews, he's telling a story of how his own experience has been similar and different from other people throughout the state. And so in addition to that display that's going to be in place, looking at structural inequality, or as Yasser oftentimes talks about, structural violence, right, related to homelessness throughout the state, Dr. Payne and Daryl Chambers, or Wolfie, is going to be a part of the panel discussion, drawing on the research that they've done with their participatory action research that contributed to the People's Report, as well as Murdertown USA.
Street Par.
Yes, Street Par.
Yeah, we know all about it.
Yes.
Actually, that's what Dr. Payne was talking about when he was sitting over there where Bill sat.
Yeah. So he does awesome work. And whenever I was a grad student, Daryl Chambers and I, we actually were in the same cohort together. So we entered into grad school together, and I've known him for a lot of years and seen the work that he's been doing along with Yasser. And it's really impressive stuff. And so shout out to both of them. Daryl's doing great stuff in Wilmington with the Center for Structural Equity. And Yasser Payne, in addition to doing his usual street par and constant public speaking, it seems, he's been a big advocate trying to get some compassionate release legislation and reform in place. So we'll be talking about the overlap of just structural inequality and violence and how it relates to the criminal justice system and ideally successful reentry.
As we always say, Carl will put a link to this in the show notes.
The show agenda.
And if you're listening to this on the day it comes out, and we know there's about 75 to 100 sickos that listen to it on the day that it comes out. So there's some sick people out there. And here's the other thing. Some of those people are not patrons to the podcast, which I feel like, come on, people.
These are the sickos who they're listening, and it's 9 a.m. Friday right now.
Like, they're giving me feedback at, like, 10 a.m. because they've already processed the whole thing. But do they pay $2 to $5 a month? They don't. Some of them do. But look, patreon.com/thehighlandsbunker. You know you're listening to it going to work right now. It just came out. Carl literally just uploaded it to the internet 45 minutes ago. And what are you doing? Nothing. You're not helping us. Carl's fucking starving. If it wasn't for the dinner I made tonight, God, be starving. Tanya, thank you for coming. I think we can do we have time to do like a fun thing, or like a go off on a tangent? Do we have time to do that? I know Carl's been keeping time. He's doing this. He's been keeping tight time. So this is a good time to announce, because I don't think I've officially sort of announced this, because I kind of was like hinting at it during the summer, my eyeball doesn't work right, and everybody knows I couldn't see before, and all that stuff. So, folks, I feel obligated to tell you that my eyesight is pretty much cooked. I can see stuff, like I cook tonight. I can do things in the neighborhood. That's fine. But I'm not going to be doing any precise sort of carpentry or anything. You know what I mean?
Flying any helicopters?
No. Well, I'll never do that. Don't ever get on a helicopter. We know that. It's a death trap. So why would you do that? Stupid. Unless you're being airlifted out of a country because of it, the government is falling to Islamic extremists or something, or your head's been blown open and they need to airlift you to Johns Hopkins or something. Other than that, if you're just like flying to Sag Harbor
from MBNA.
Yeah, you know, yeah, from, yeah, 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 yeah. If you're just going from like a helipad in Manhattan to Montauk, I kind of hope you die. You know,
satire.
This is all satire. Everybody knows that. But yeah, so my vision's not great. It's not going to be any better. So I'm learning new things. I'm listening to books. I'm not reading books. It's actually working out okay. I'm getting help for like administrative stuff. And I want to thank Tanya specifically for sort of understanding my plight and really helping me out in places I've been. So we were in Tucson, and I came out to the patio because I was told that there was going to be free drinks, and I might be blind, but I'm not fucking missing free drinks, am I? And I'm sort of standing there, like looking up in the air, and I hear Rob. And I'm like, thank God somebody sees me. And so Tanya pulls me over to the table, but there's no chair there.
He goes over and hugs a cactus by mistake.
Yeah. And I'm like, ow.
Sorry.
And so she's like, sit in this chair. So I sit in the chair and I'm like, oh, thank God. And then she disappears because she has to find another chair. She goes all the way down, probably by like the pool, gets a chair. She's going through a crowd of like, she trips over the fucking fountain. To get there, I thought people were like, "Oh my God!" I couldn't see what was happening. They were like, "Oh my God, you fell!" I'm like, "I can't see it. I don't know what's happening.
I'm not responsible for that."
I'm like, "I didn't like. All I did was sit down. That's all I did." But in any case, I want to thank you for being someone who has like sort of helped me through this sort of weird time that I'm in. Again, like I was telling people like. I'm a little bit lucky because I don't live in the suburbs. I don't drive. I stopped sort of driving. I haven't owned a car in 8 months. I think if I lived in the suburbs and drove every day, I'd be in a shit place right now. But I don't
Pretty
do that.
Isolated.
Yeah, so I'd be in a real terrible spot. But yeah. I'm not in that situation, so I'm dealing with it okay. But Tanya specifically has been a big help. To sort of like, obviously Susan has been as well, and everybody's been real cool at DCJ at ODS of like sort of helping me get acclimated to my new life. But yeah, thanks. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, no worries. I'm happy to. Makes a difference knowing someone. My husband is blind, so it definitely makes it a little more understanding. And you know, whenever I first heard you say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm dealing with my eyes. I was like, no. No sorries about it, yeah. Because like, if you could have otherwise, I'm sure you would.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little bit weird. Again, like, it's one thing to sort of have been ready for it, but now that it's happened, I haven't, like, I've been okay, and I'm like, wow, am I this mature? Am I handling this okay? Or is it going to, like, in 2 weeks, am I going to freak out? Like, I don't know. I think it helps that it's been... My whole life, it's been very sort of gradual. This has been like a sort of a big step down. And again, I can see stuff. Like, I can get on the bus. I went to the pub today. Went to the Acme today. Great. I can't read shit. I can't see people's faces. You know, people are like, that was the weird thing about being in Tucson. I was like, people would come up, hey, how are you doing? I'm like, I don't know who this is. You know. So when you're in a big crowd, it's a little bit tricky. But yeah, fuck it. I got shit to do. You know, we're reforming the police here in Delaware. And you know, we're taking every small step we can to exploit little cracks in the system. Because we can't keep it this way. There's two new, I point people's attention to the two new detailed narratives on the Criminal Justice Council website about Newcastle County police just firing at moving cars and cruisers and stuff.
Any resolution or findings?
Yeah,
I guess there are findings.
No misconduct. It's fine. You can just do whatever you want. You know, it's what, I mean, hey, we're cops. We got Bill of Rights. Bill of Rights. Freedom of speech and religion. Assembly. And we can kick your ass. Stun gun you. You know, shoot at a car. It's fun. God damn it. Well, thank you, Tanya, for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah. This is what we do here. This is just goofy stuff that we do. Folks, come to the bookshop tonight if you're hearing this on Friday, because I'm going to be there. And if you have any problem with what I said, I'm going to fight you in the street. I can't even see. Mm-hmm. You're going to hit a, not only would you hit a guy with glasses, you hit a guy literally that can't see. I still fight you.
Not a good look.
I still fight you anyway, though. Yeah. I don't care. I don't give a shit. Bill, thanks.
Anytime.
Carl, thank you. Thank you for keeping us on track, too, by the way. I really appreciate that.
Carl's in charge.
Carl's in charge of our days and our nights. He looked like he was going to say something, but he's not going to say it. Say
Carl,
it.
Carl, any big predictions for Tuesday?
The only thing that's going to happen Tuesday. Oh, ooh. Oh, fuck it. Left is best.